crossing a membrane. So they start on one side of a membrane, and they go through the other side through a nanoscale hole in that membrane. And many different biological objects do this, DNA, RNA, proteins, and as we'll see in this talk, also viruses. So why is this of interest? Well, if we consider a nanopore device in water, and there's ions and counterions in that water, and we apply a field to the system to drive that object through the pore, then we're also going to get a flow of ions through that pore. And so if there's nothing in the system, we will get a current trace, baseline current trace, that looks like this. And then if an object enters a pore, so in this case, in this schematic, it's a strand of DNA. If it enters the pore, it will partially block this ionic current. So if we're looking at the current trace, we'll see these characteristic dips in the current trace. And so by looking at the time that the object blocks the current in the pore, we should be able to size DNA. And we can take this even a step further. And if we look in detail at this drop in the current trace here, you can actually do, under very careful conditions, is you can actually discriminate which base is in the pore at any time. And so there's been a lot of research for DNA going through a nanopore, basically as the platform for next generation sequencing devices. And some of the most exciting work is coming out of Oxford Nanopore in the UK. What they have is an enzyme that takes double-stranded DNA and feeds a single strand of it through a biological pore. And they're able to detect which pores are in the base at any one time. And so this means that with just, you know, a very simple device, they're able to cheaply, rapidly sequence even just a single strand of DNA. And so eventually they're trying to commercialize this. It should be out this year, I think, but they said that last year too. And so it's going to be on basically like a USB thumb drive that you can hook into your computer and start sequencing. And so this would be revolutionary because it could really usher in the era of personalized medicine, where diagnosis and therapeutic treatment is based more on your genetic code than on the average, the makeup of the population at large. So there's been a lot of research on DNA going through nanopores. What I'd like to talk about today is slightly different. I'm going to look at a virus going through the nanopore. And the virus I'm going to be considering is the FD virus. And it's a bacteriophage, which means that it actually infects strands of E. coli. And it's rigid and filamentous, which basically means it's a long, slender rod. So its contour length is about 880 nanometers. And its persistence length is somewhere between 2200 and 2800 nanometers. So its persistence length is about 3 times its contour length, which means it's quite rigid. Its diameter is only 6.6 nanometers, so it's also quite slender. And so this is an image of a single FD virus, and here we have many of them. And you see that although it can bend, it's generally in an elongated configuration because of the high persistence length. So why is this of interest? Well, there's nanotech applications coming out using FD viruses. So what they do is they can functionalize the end, and these things can self-assemble into different structures. So that's pretty cool. It also can be, for more medical applications, it can be a proxy for detecting E. coli. Since it infects E. coli, if you find a lot of FD virus in your water sample, for example, then you might have a contaminated sample where E. coli is present. It's also similar, although this bacteriophage is non-pathogenic to humans, it's similar to ones that are, particularly ones that cause the Marburg and Ebola virus. And so if we can come up with a way of detecting these, it could be very beneficial in different settings, clinical settings. Okay, and the other reason it's interesting is that while a lot of research has been done on double-stranded DNA, double-stranded DNA is quite flexible compared to the FD virus. So it represents another limit here of looking at a stiff object going through the pore instead of a flexible one. And so why is this important? Well, let's consider FD versus dsDNA and show that flexibility matters. So if we have, let's say, double-stranded DNA going through a pore, and so we measure the translocation time, that is, how long it takes to go through the pore and get from one side of the membrane to the other side of the membrane. And so we end up with the distribution of translocation times. Well, what controls that spread in the distribution? And there's 2 factors. The first is, at these small scales, Brownian motion is a very large factor. So you have a lot of back and forth going on just because of the thermal kicks of the solvent. The other thing is that it depends on the initial configuration of the polymer at capture. So if you have a strand of DNA that is captured by the pore when it's pretty compressed near the pore, it's going to go through faster than one that is in a very elongated state where many monomers are far from the pore. So we have 2 sources of dispersion in our distribution. And then if we consider the FD virus, we're still going to have this back and forth Brownian motion, but the initial configurations are much more limited than for the more flexible double-stranded DNA. And so in principle, we should have a much narrower distribution of translocation times. Okay, and you can come up in the rod-like limit, come up with a simple prediction for what the distribution looks like. And this is a form you get here. And the important part here is this D parallel, which is the diffusion coefficient according to the long axis of the virus. And in principle, the width of the distribution is solely determined by this diffusion coefficient. That's the only thing it depends on. So what this means is that we should have very narrow distributions, and we should be able to identify with high certainty when we have an FD virus going through our sample, going through our nanopore device. Okay, so flexibility matters for translocation times. It also matters for the capture process. If we consider having a DNA near a pore, then it's so flexible that regardless of its configuration, an end of the DNA can always find its way into the pore and precipitate translocation. For the FD virus, if it hits the pore head on, no problem. But if it gets caught lengthwise, then it's too stiff to bend and go through. And so it actually can get stuck. So again, this is another fundamental difference that comes solely from a difference in flexibility. So I work with experimentalists and I do the simulations. So I come up with a simple model for the FD virus. And it's a semi-flexible polymer made up of basically balls connected by springs. And the diameter of the bead we'll call 1 sigma. And to get the right aspect ratio, I need 133 beads for my polymer. And I also impose a bending potential so that I get the stiffness. And that gives a persistence length of about 423, which means I have the right ratio of persistence length to contour length according to actual FD viruses. I also need a nanopore. And this is just a hole cut in a continuous surface here. The pore diameter and the pore length are again scaled to match experimental conditions. Now, an important part of the simulation is the external field that I apply across the system. And so, in order to properly implement this in the simulations, I solve it with a finite difference approach. And as expected, so here's high potential, low potential, we see that the steepest gradient in the potential, so the highest fields, occur over the pore itself. However, there are non-negligible gradients outside of the pore, and we'll see that these are important for the capture process. The simulation method itself is based on molecular dynamics, so basically F equals ma. I can calculate the force on each bead at each point in time, calculate the acceleration, integrate once to get the velocity, integrate again to get the position, and this way I can generate the trajectory in time. I perform Langevin dynamics, so I don't have an explicit solvent in the system. I include the effects of the solvent implicitly in the equation of motion. And so this means I have a drag term and a thermal kick term, which is my stochastic noise term arising from thermal fluctuations. So if I put all of this together, I get simulations that look like this. And the two red beads here denote the edges of the nanopore. And this is the membrane here, the blue line. And so I equilibrate the polymer far from the pore, and then I transport it closer so that I don't have to wait forever for this thing to be captured. And once it's closer to the pore, I then let diffusion initially bring the virus even closer to the pore, and then let the field through drift capture the pore and bring it, or sorry, capture the polymer and have it translocate through the pore here. And so, of course, the nice thing about simulations is that we have access to details that can't be measured in an experiment. And what's important for this talk is that I can measure details about the state of the polymer at the point of capture. So I can quantify its orientation and also things such as which monomer hits the pore first. So just a quick word about computation. So these simulations were mostly done on SharkNet. And today I'm pleased to announce I have a very highly effective method for parallelization. It scales perfectly across hundreds of cores. And that, of course, is serial computing. Okay? And so what I'm able to do is, because I need an ensemble average, I can just launch many jobs with different seeds, and I'm very quickly able to get good ensemble averages and also highly detailed distributions to extract the features that I want. And so given the audience, I'd just like to put in a plug that it's not always the sexiest grant application to write, but serial computing, you get a lot of bang for your buck. Okay. So let's start by looking at some experimental results. And so here are the current traces I was talking about before. And what we see is kind of two different types of events. One event are short-lasting events, and they don't cause too much of a charge deficit. And distinct from that, we see deeper events that last longer. And we're going to classify these as collisions and translocations. And this is at a low field, 60 millivolts. If we increase the field, we again see a discrimination between collisions and translocations, but it's getting harder to discriminate them as we increase the field. So what's the difference between these events? Well, if we consider the virus approaching the pore, then if we have a translocation event and the virus goes into the pore, it's going to block a lot of current. It's also going to take a significant amount of time, especially at low fields, for this virus to go through. So we're going to end up with events that are deep and long-lasting. Collisions are when the virus approaches the pore, but it's not in a good configuration to thread through it. So it only partially blocks the current, so our dips here are not as deep. And also, it can kind of go near the pore and then through thermal fluctuations diffuse away a little bit and come back. And so you kind of see this flickering on the current signal here, and what we guess is that the polymer is trying to enter the pore over that time. So we go to simulations to test this qualitative picture. And so first, let's just look at some images of the polymer at different, when it's captured by the pore. And let's try and figure out what discriminates the events. And so at low fields here, we see that these angles here are the angle with respect to the axis of the pore. So the lower the angle number, the more the polymer is aligned with the pore, okay, which we expect to be a good configuration to translocate. So events that the polymer arrives aligned, the black events indicate translocation events, and the red ones indicate stuck events. And so if it's aligned here, we get these two translocating through. But even for these, which are relatively aligned, the polymer gets in a stuck configuration. And over here, when it arrives in a lateral position or transverse position, it's most likely to get stuck. However, here we have one that's arriving very lateral to the pore, and it reorients in time to translocate. If we increase the field, the picture changes quite a bit. Look at all the black numbers here. So we're much more likely to have a successful translocation event. The polymer is also much more likely to arrive in an aligned configuration. The field is higher. And when it doesn't arrive in aligned configuration here, we see a stuck event. So let's try and quantify these results. And the first thing we'll do is look at these angles we were just talking about. So here I'm plotting the angle on the x-axis here and the probability of finding that angle on the y-axis here, appropriately normalized. And at low fields, we kind of see we have two peaks. It either arrives in a aligned state and will generally translocate, or it arrives in a lateral state and it will become stuck lengthwise across the pore. As we increase the field, we're much more likely to arrive in an aligned state because the field will pull the polymer such that it arrives aligned, and the field is so much stronger than thermal fluctuations that this thing won't reorient in time to get stuck across the pore. And so these events, of course, are much more likely to translocate. We can also look at this by looking at which monomer hits the pore first. So let's look at the index of the monomer, which is plotted on the x-axis here. And I'm only looking at translocation events here. So this is just the number of events in which we witness translocation. So at high forces, we see that if an event results in a translocation, it's either caught by the very first monomer or the very last monomer. Recall that I have 103 monomers total. And if it's caught by any other monomer, we don't get a translocation event. At the lowest field, which is lambda equals 1, it's still most likely to be caught by the ends if we have a translocation event, but it can also be caught quite far from the ends, and because the field is low, it can reorient in time to have a translocation event. And so there's two kind of competing effects here. As you increase the field, the polymer is more likely to arrive in an aligned state. However, at high fields, if it doesn't arrive in an aligned state, it will remain stuck. And at low fields, if you are in a stuck state, you have a probability of realigning and going through. So there's two kind of competing mechanisms, and which one wins? Well, overall, the probability of translocation increases dramatically as we increase the field strength. So the alignment is the most important factor for precipitating translocation. Okay, so that's the capture process. Let's just look at the translocation times. And so again, these are experimental results. And we're looking at the distribution of the translocation times at the low field of 60 millivolts and a higher field of 120 millivolts. And we get curves that correspond to the theoretical form that we predicted earlier. And remember, the only thing that really matters there is D parallel, which is this diffusion coefficient. Okay? Now, of course, we would expect this diffusion coefficient to be independent of the field. Okay? It's just the thermal kicks from the solvent. However, if we fit these distributions and extract D parallel from the fits, and we plot D parallel here, so the data points are D parallel for different pore sizes, we see that D parallel is actually increasing as we're increasing the voltage here. That is, at high fields, the dispersion is much wider than we would expect from Brownian motion alone. So where is this extra dispersion in the distribution of translocation times coming from? And note that this is also seen in the simulation. So this is an overlay of simulation and experimental results here. We get similar distributions with similar widths. So we turned to the simulations again, and we started to look at a couple different factors of where this extra dispersion, this extra variance in the translocation time could come from. And so we thought, well, maybe it depends on the angle of the polymer at threading. So if it's a more oblique angle, maybe it takes longer to go through than when it arrives in a really aligned state. Okay, if we look at the simulations, this actually, we find no correlation between the angle and the translocation time. Well, how about the lateral placement on the pore? So maybe if you have a virus that's dead on and it doesn't interact with the edges at all, that goes faster or maybe even slower than one that is closer to the edge of the pore. Okay, again, we find no correlation between these factors. But where I did find a correlation, and it was somewhat unexpected, is between the initial configuration of the FD virus at capture and the translocation time. So here I'm plotting the translocation time against the end-to-end distance of the polymer at the point of capture. For low fields here, so these are increasing field magnitudes. So this is 1 all the way up to 12. And so we expected that since FD is so stiff, we don't have to worry about the initial configuration. But what this shows is that the initial configuration still matters. And here's why it matters. Even though it's stiff, it can bend a little bit. And so if we have an FD virus that is in an elongated state, okay, as opposed to one that's bent, the bent one will have more monomers in a high field region. And also, because it's slightly bent and it's not elongated, the effective drag on the polymer is also lower over the whole translocation process. And so what this means is that the initial configuration matters, and so these look like scatter plots. If you just do a line of best fit, you start to see this dependency emerge here. And there's a weak correlation here, but it is enough to add extra dispersion to the translocation times. And so we also see from these plots that this correlation is increasing as we increase the field. So why is that? Well, at a very high field, if we're caught in a certain configuration, then that's going to have a great influence on our translocation time. At a lower field, we translocate slower. And so if we're in some configuration here, while we're translocating, the virus is still being kicked around, and the initial configuration is lost more quickly. So at low fields, the effect of the initial configuration is actually washed out because translocation is slow compared to the relaxation time on the cis side. And so this correlation emerges as we increase the field. And so now, if we plot the percent increase in our diffusion coefficient as measured from simulations, these are the black dots, and we also plot a measurement of the correlation, we see that the two line up exactly. Okay, there's excellent agreement between the two. So it seems that this initial configuration is enough to explain the extra dispersion in the simulation results. So this is really encouraging. And then so we went back and we said, well, is this enough to explain it in the experiments? And so remember this plot. This red line is the standard D parallel. It's what we would expect from theory. These points here are the D parallel for different pore sizes. And the black line is the D parallel we would predict from simulations, including this effect of extra dispersion from the initial configuration. And we see that at low field, it seems to do a pretty good job of matching up what's going on here. But here at the highest field, 120 millivolts is the standard voltage for these experiments. It explains at best 60% of the lowest data point here. Okay? So it's part of the picture, but it's clearly not all of the picture. Something else is going on. And what else could be at play here? Well, first of all, the electric field profile is more complicated than what I have in the model. Because in the model, I assumed the membrane is just an insulating barrier. Okay? But of course, there's charges all over the place on that membrane there. Okay? So that could introduce some lateral field dependence as well. So we're looking at that right now. And another really big factor is that if there's any sort of friction between the virus and the pore, this will introduce a lot of variance in your translocation times. Okay? And currently in the model, it's purely a steric interaction between the virus and the pore. So there's no friction at all. Okay? So this is something else we can build into the simulations and test the impact of it. Okay, so in conclusion, the simulations were able to reveal details that the experiments didn't have access to. Okay? So details of the capture process to help explain these flickerings in the current, and the dependence on the field strength for the capture process as well, this kind of two-sided effect of the field. And also, some of the extra dispersion was explained by the dependence on the initial configuration that we found in the simulations. But there's more out there, and so that's what we're working on right now. Okay, so if you're interested in this project and others like it, please visit my website. Feel free to contact me at my email for any reason whatsoever. And I'd like to thank you for your time.
Okay, so let's thank Professor Dehan for his talk. And we have time for a few short questions. Exercise today.
How well do you take into account the fact that the solvent in which the experiments are done is actually polar?
Is actually
a polar solvent. You're talking about water-based experiments.
Yes.
So the higher your field, the more interferences you're going to get from the solvent as well. So doing just the implicit solvent may not capture everything that you're seeing.
Absolutely. So there's huge effects of the solvent. The first is just that you mentioned there is electrodynamic interactions. There's Debye screening. This also comes really into play when you start looking at the interaction between the virus and the pore. And it's even worse than that. Okay. There's also effects of the water due to hydrodynamic interactions. Okay. So in the experiment, of course, the diffusion coefficient for the virus going along its long axis is much different than it is going on its lateral axis, okay? That isn't even true in the simulations if we have implicit solvent, okay? So this is still very coarse-grained, and we're starting to build those features in. Yeah, that's a great point.
Hi, what you would expect if you have not one virus, but number of viruses close together, trying to get through one pore?
Oh, like a competition effect between going in? Yeah, it's a really good question. It hasn't been studied too much. Almost all these experiments, I think all of them actually, are done in the dilute limit to exactly avoid that effect. Yeah. But that being said, there is one of the things that plagues nanopore development as a sequencing device is that you frequently get clogged pores. And so you get something that goes in there, and it just doesn't move, okay, due to whatever, friction. It's still not exactly clear what's going on there. And so then if you have a clogged pore, the experiment just ends. So if you have a bunch of them in there and it gets clogged, that'll be the end of it.